Welcome to the CCTA Wake Up Call Show. Thank you for joining us. Thank you for hanging around and listening to our sponsors and supporters, listening to what we're talking about today. Just want to say, my name is Bob Griswold.
Mary Griswold.
Alan Harrop.
Pat Park.
Michael Byrne.
Glenn Fink.
As you could tell, we have a candidate for Justice Michael Byrne right now as a candidate. And welcome, welcome, welcome.
Now, you are a candidate for?
I'm a candidate for seat one on the North Carolina Court of Appeals for both the primary and then hopefully for the general election in November.
Okay. Do you want to tell us a little bit about your background and your qualifications?
Yes, ma'am. So I grew up in Wake County between Raleigh and Wake Forest. My parents were state employees. My father worked for what is now DHHS for 33 years. My mother was a public school elementary teacher in Wake County. I graduated from Wake County Public Schools, went to undergraduate at North Carolina State in Raleigh, received my bachelor's there in English. Between college and law school, I worked in D.C. for L. Brent Bozell at the Media Research Center. He's the man who made liberal media bias sort of a household word. I got that job because while I was at NC State, I was editor of the first student conservative newspaper ever founded there. And I also interned for the John Locke Foundation. So that was got me some writing experience, which then led to the DC job. The DC job was a lot of fun, but a year or so later, I made the decision that law's kind of what makes our political society tick. So I came back to North Carolina and went to law school at Campbell, graduated from there, looked around at some of the jobs, and I said, I think I can do better and be happier as an entrepreneur, that I can open my own law firm. And everyone said, well, no, you got to go work somewhere and get some experience. And I said, well, the way to get experience is by going out and doing it. So that's what I did. And a couple times during the first year, as you might imagine, I was like, what are you doing?
Uh-huh.
You know, I was like, I'm the only guy in the world who goes to work every day in a suit and tie and loses money. But it was a great thing because in those days, there were some lawyers and judges who would mentor you and help you out. A lot wouldn't. But over the years, I gained some experience. And then fast forwarding to 2005, I made the decision to concentrate on representing two groups of people, law enforcement and state employees. Most of their cases are heard in the Office of Administrative Hearings, which is the administrative court where I'm now a judge. Between 2005 and 2020, I did 272 cases in that court alone. That also got me a lot of experience on our appeals courts. When you take on the state, which is what I was doing in almost all of those cases, the taxpayers pay for their lawyers. So they didn't have a cost consideration in terms of appealing. So the net on that is I did more than 20 cases individually in the Court of Appeals and Supreme Court representing those groups and some others. Was fortunate enough to win a lot of them, including a case in the Supreme Court that essentially changed the way that state human resources cases are interpreted. I also was asked by several organizations to be, and you notice, an amicus. Mm-hmm. And that's basically a fancy word for an organization wants to be heard on an important case, and they will ask an attorney to submit a brief on their behalf. So I was an amicus in the Supreme Court for the North Carolina Fraternal Order of Police, for the North Carolina Police Benevolent Association, for NAPO, which is a national organization, and for the State Employees Association of North Carolina. Moving forward to around 2020, I was thinking one day, you know, what do I want on my sort of metaphorical professional headstone? Do I want it to just say he was blessed with a successful career, he saved a lot of people's jobs, he sued a lot of governors' administrations, which I did, and you know, he made a good bit of money. And I decided I wanted to give back a little bit. So I became an administrative law judge in June 2020. since I began that job, I've issued nearly 400 legal decisions of various kinds, some very, very highly complex, such as certificate of need law.
We've had reason to talk about that.
Right. And people ask me about the CON law all the time, and I say I have no opinion about it, because if I had opinions, I'd want to go to the General Assembly. What I do is I interpret that law correctly, and I've been appealed to the Court of Appeals 3 times on CON and been affirmed. I do think, like I said earlier, one measure of how a judge does their job is, you know, how often they appeal and what happens when they are. I've had 9 cases appealed to the Court of Appeals since I became administrative law judge, including those 3 CON cases, and all 9 have been unanimously affirmed by a Republican-controlled Court of Appeals. And I think, now, I had some help on that. Some good attorneys defended my decisions, but in my most recent one, there was no one on the other side. So my decision had to stand on its own, and fortunately, because it was a due process case, and that's a vital consideration of mine, it did. So I think what that can tell you is that I consistently get the law right, and I take it seriously. So,
and he writes his own opinions. No clerks.
No clerks. No AI either. Huh?
No. we do have clerks, but. Again, I drafted decisions for administrative law judges and wrote briefs in the Court of Appeals for nearly 20 years. So it's kind of like in college, I played foosball a lot and I got kind of good at it. And I'm not trying to be facetious, but when you do something a long time, you know, I'm an amateur competition motorsports instructor. That's my other hobby. And we have a saying, it's called seat time. There's no substitute for seat time. That means actually being in the car, on the track, racing other cars or racing, you know, timers or whatever kind of a competition you're in. There's no substitute for actually doing it, and that makes the job easier for me.
The English major didn't hurt either.
No, ma'am. my wife and I are both English majors. My wife has a PhD in English. And I use my English degree every single day. Mm-hmm. I originally intended to major in history, but I liked history so much that I thought I wanted to broaden my horizons a little bit, and I'm very grateful that I did.
You know, as you mentioned, using the English language and using it explicitly so that, again, with your cases and with the appeals or whatever else, that you have stated things properly, that there's not ambiguity in. I listen to sometimes people say things and very, very ambiguous in what the meaning could be.
No, you're right. And one of my little, you can call it a quirk maybe, I refuse, unless I have to use Latin in my decisions. And I think Latin's a beautiful language. But when I read a judicial decision and it's peppered with things like sua sponte and inter alia, well, you're paying me, you the taxpayers are paying me to decide cases, but you're also paying me to communicate with you. And one of my police group friends, and we can, I guess maybe we'll talk about endorsements at some point, but said, one of the reasons I like your decisions is you just write in plain English. And if I don't write a decision that everyone sitting here at this table can understand, I'm really not doing my job as well as I could be, because you have to understand what I'm saying because you're paying the bill. So
that same, it would be nice if that same principle applied to the people in Congress writing our laws.
Yeah, that's kind of one I can't touch. I will say most of the time, you know, our job as judges in North Carolina, you know, we don't have in North Carolina a unitary executive like the federal government. We have what's called a plural executive. So the result of that is that I hear cases involving Democrat-controlled agencies. I hear cases involving Republican-controlled agencies. And the difference in the way I treat them is zero. Mm-hmm. Because the law, there's no law for each side. You heard me say this earlier, I think. There's no Democratic or Republican justice. There's only getting something right. And when you write simply and clearly, that eliminates ambiguity and it eliminates potential, perhaps, for people to do mischief with the law.
And it I would think, lessens the ability of people to charge you with partisanship.
Right. That fairness, there's really nothing, I think, that's more important in terms of judicial philosophy than fairness. And we hear all the time now, you know, I can't get too much into current events, but people worry that our judicial system is partisan. And if we do not have a judicial system that is rigidly nonpartisan, that is rigidly fair, that is rigidly consistent, then as a society, we're lost.
Yeah, look at
we're
New
lost.
York.
Look at
New
Well, and you may
Letitia James.
Right.
What's Bragg?
Right.
I mean, nakedly partisan, and they take it into the courtroom.
Right. And when people talk about that, we as Republicans have to be better. And we have to be consistent. We have to be, you know, they did X is not an excuse for we did Y. Mm-hmm. And something doesn't become right or wrong just because there's a D or an R next to it. And one of the reasons I became a Republican is I believe we are better, and we need to be that way.
Right. Well, it doesn't help that we've seen so much lawfare in the last 10 years.
Well, one of the other things that we need to remember is that you are there to judge the law as it's written. You're not, we often hear of emotion coming into a number of the cases that we see, and, oh, I wish it was this way. Guess what? The law is not written that way. Go back to the legislature. Get the law changed. But until it's changed, this is the way it's got to be.
You're right. I mean, I make decisions every week I don't like, but it's not my job to like a decision. It's my job to implement the law as a General Assembly and the Constitution say it should be done. It's really that simple.
So you're an originalist.
I've got to be. Article 1, Section 35 says a frequent recurrence to fundamental principles is absolutely necessary to secure the blessings of liberty.
That's, there you go.
That means remember why you're here.
There you go.
And so you kind of have to be an originalist if you believe in the North Carolina Constitution as written, which I do.
As written, yes.
No living constitutionalist here.
I don't believe so, ma'am.
By the way, I'm going to jump in to say one other thing. The CCTA, Coastal Carolinas Taxpayers Association, we're a 501c3 organization. We cannot endorse candidates, but we can sure as heck have them here and have them talking about whatever they need to talk about. And we've invited many, many candidates here and have them and appreciate you coming here.
Well, I'm grateful you have me.
Okay. On that, we're going to take another quick break to hear from our sponsors and supporters. This is CCTA Wake Up Call.
At Professional Auto Service, keeping vehicles in top form and running well isn't just their business, it's the passion of folks who work there. If baling wire and duct tape is good enough, don't go near them. But if you take pride in your vehicle and reliability is important, go to 2215 Country Club Road in New Bern and let Professional Auto take care of your vehicle. You'll be pleased. That's Professional Auto Service, Country Club Road, New Bern.
Other restaurants claim their food is fresh and fast, but are they friendly? At Moore's, you're treated like family the minute you walk into their doors. With locations in Winterville, New Bern, Swansboro, Moorhead City, and Jacksonville, we've been practicing what we preach since 1945. At Moore's, our barbecue is slow-cooked and smoked over real wood daily until it's so tender it's falling off the bone. Combined with our fresh chicken, cooked-to-order seafood, and homemade fixins, we're sure you'll agree. If it's not Moore's, it's less.
Since 1952, the North Carolina Fisheries Association has been working to ensure access for fishermen and consumers to enjoy fresh local seafood. The North Carolina Fisheries Association is for fair, science-based fisheries management for commercial and recreational fishermen. If you agree with this philosophy, become a member. For more information, log on to ncfish.org. For fresh North Carolina seafood, there's no better place than B&J Seafood, Highway 70 East in New Bern.
The County Compass is a rapidly growing, free weekly newspaper throughout eastern North Carolina. At the County Compass, we believe small business is the future of our great nation. many small business owners have discovered that an ad in the County Compass each week is the most effective, the most affordable way to reach thousands of readers from all walks of life. At the County Compass, we focus entirely on local and regional news, coverage of important issues that directly affect your life. At the County Compass, we love our readers, and we love our advertisers. This Thursday and every Thursday at more than 750 distribution points throughout Eastern North Carolina, pick up your free copy of the County Compass newspaper.
Welcome back. Again, thank you for listening to our sponsors and supporters, and we ask you to visit them and just let them know that you heard about them on our talk show. Justice, you got another story.
So we were talking off break that y'all came from Massachusetts, and the movie that made me want to become a lawyer, my dad, when I was 14, 1982, took me to see a movie called The Verdict.
Oh, I love that movie.
With Paul Newman.
Yeah.
And it was about, a lawyer taking on an incredibly powerful opponent on behalf of someone who was completely powerless against basically impossible odds. And at the end of the film, Paul Newman, and he had an unfair judge. You remember how he would look at the judge and say, if you're going to try the case for me, don't lose it for me?
Yeah.
It was Irish actor named Milo O'Shea played
that. And Newman was playing a down-and-out lawyer.
Right.
So he was trying to redeem himself as well as his client.
Right. And no one gave him a chance. And he was taking on a very, very powerful enemy. And he looks at the jury at the end of the film, and he says to them, today you are the law. You are the law, not marble statues, not the trappings of the court. You are the law. And he urges them to do justice. And at 14, I didn't know really much about the law, but I sure liked that. And I think that's what eventually led me to this career path, that the law can be a powerful force for good, as we've seen in some current events. It can be a force for abuse, which I stand very strongly against. But the law is what gives us a civilized society. So,
now, what would you say is your most important qualification for this job?
I would argue there are two things. The first is my experience that we talked about before. Simply, the more you do something, the better you tend to be at it. And that's not universal. I mean, there's been people making the same mistake for 30 years, and we could talk about some of them. But you know, having been at the Court of Appeals so many times, having written so many briefs, having my work reviewed by the Court of Appeals, it feels like, in some extent, familiar ground. And I don't remember what case it was. It was maybe 13th, 15th, doesn't matter. There was a really nice guy named Dick Ellis. He's unfortunately passed away. But he was the marshal of the Court of Appeals. And he was a very good Republican, very genial man. He looked at me and he said, Mr. Byrne? And I said, yes, Mr. Marshal. He says, I'm appointing you a frequent flyer of this court. And that was a great day for me. The second thing is my general judicial philosophy, and that takes two forms. The first is get it right. I was hired by the director of OAH to be an administrative law judge. He'd been there 32 years. He'd known me for 15. And he said, you've done almost 300 cases here. Go do your job. And he said, Michael, get it right. And that's been my lodestar ever since. The second element of that, of course, is recognizing that we as judges are here to implement the will of the people as expressed by the General Assembly. We don't have a strictly equal governmental structure here. Our founders put the General Assembly in charge. We follow that. The exception to that, and the sole exception to that, you hear judges talk about, well, I'm a Clarence Thomas man or Scalia man. That's all great. I mean, I have a bunch of Justice Scalia's books. I'm what you call Bayard v. Singleton man. And what that means is North Carolina courts, our Supreme Court, exercised the power of judicial review several years before Marbury versus Madison. There was a law passed by the General Assembly, and the details don't matter, but it involved property that was confiscated from Tories, British loyalists, during the Revolution. And it was heard in New Bern. You can see there's a historical marker in New Bern. You can go right down by the courthouse today and see it. And our Supreme Court said, in essence, we would are really, really reluctant to disagree with the General Assembly. We are. But we have a job, too. And our job is to be true to the Constitution, which they said, and here's the important part, is the supreme law of the land. And our Constitution is the supreme law of the land because the General Assembly is the people. The Constitution is you. That's what protects you. And they said a law that conflicts with the Constitution cannot stand. And the General Assembly got so mad that, you know what they did? They cut their pay. So yeah,
sounds you could pretty petty.
Make all kinds of comments about that, which I will not do. But we have a constitutional history in this state that is very rich, very liberty protective. Our Constitution gives more rights than the federal, including a right to work at your chosen profession without interference from the government, particularly an ordinary and harmless profession. Mm. I've used that provision many times, protecting the rights of our law enforcement officers. And I am a fan of our state constitution and very, very strongly believe it needs to be enforced.
Well, not only enforced, but it needs to be publicized more than it is. How would you go about publicizing the Constitution?
Well, I would encourage every citizen to simply read it. It's on the General Assembly's website. It's on multiple government websites. And there are parts of it, you know, if you quiz me about what, say, the education section said, I probably might look a little frantic. But the parts that apply to my regular job, you know, I know them. And that is literally our foundational document. Again, that was written in 1776. And we've had two successive ones since. You know, we had the 1868 Constitution, which one side of my family would call the Reconstruction Constitution, and one other side of my family would call the Bayonet Constitution, depending on who you talk to. But then we have the Constitution of 1971. And what's amazing about that is the preamble to our current Constitution begins by acknowledging Almighty God as the sovereign ruler of nations. And Article 1, Section 1 of our Bill of Rights, you know, the four rights are life, liberty, the rights of the fruits of your own labor, and the pursuit of happiness. But it says we are endowed by our Creator with those rights. And that's an important distinction.
Something that the government cannot control.
Yeah. Right. And that's just acknowledging that. Our religious liberty provision, Article 1, Section 13, free to worship Almighty God according to the dictates of his own conscience. One of my opponent is running, saying essentially, we're part of a group. I look at that and I think about the shortest section of the Constitution. That's Article 1, Section 10. And all it says is all elections shall be free, period. And that means that nobody but you picks our judges. Voters pick our judges. And as a matter of fact, in Article 4, Section 16, it specifically places the right to elect judges of the Court of Appeals and Supreme Court justices with the voters. And there's nothing in there about anybody else, not any political party, not any group, just you, the voters. It is your job, and it is constitutionally placed in your hands, and I'm darn glad that it is.
So within the state constitution, more courts are established or recognized within the state constitution than in the federal constitution.
That's true. That's a very good point that, honestly, I hadn't thought a lot about. But the Court of Appeals was established in 1967, and it serves as what is known as an error-correcting court. They hear appeals from administrative law judges like me and Superior Court and District Court. And did we follow the rules? And that's another area, ma'am, where I think my experience helps. because to use a sports analogy, and I'm a North Carolina boy, so I have sports analogies for everything. They're like referees. And I say this, and I said this earlier, if I'm applying for your job as a referee, wouldn't you want to know how much I actually played football? I mean, would that be important to you?
The Kansas City Chiefs are playing in the game.
Right.
They have an exemption.
Yeah. But so, you know, I'm probably getting on dangerous ground when I bring various teams into it. But that's just a sort of perhaps overly glib way of saying that I think experience matters.
If you are elected, exactly what are you elected for, and what are the duties of that office?
That's a great question. So it's an 8-year term. And you know, unlike the federal courts, you know, you become a federal judge, you're there forever. If you don't like what I'm doing 8 years from now, you can kick me out. That's what you have your right as voters. But our duties, I don't want to say are because I'm not on the court, but their duties are to hear appeals from the trial divisions of the General Court of Justice, from the Office of Administrative Hearings, and review them for legal error. And that's the long and the short of it.
You know, it's funny. You mentioned the state constitution.
Yes, sir.
And I'm going to say, just like we've been told a number of times, if you want to understand the state constitution, you need to read it, not books about it, but you need to read it. And likewise, if you want to understand the Bible, you need to read the Bible, not books about the Bible. And it sounds silly.
You'll get no argument from me. I mean, that makes perfect sense.
And I just wondering, as you go through and you've judged these cases before you based on their consistency with the law written in the Constitution, are there ever any times where you come across things in the Constitution that perhaps are not as clear or as worded correctly or might need to be refined in some way to make the interpretation of the Constitution more definitive? You follow what I'm saying?
I do.
It seems to me like as a judge, you go through and you're trying to sort these out and you see the way the Constitution's written, that some refinement to how it's worded or whatever might clarify the intent and so on.
Well, and that's a great question. And my simple, honest answer is no. Our state constitution is very, very well and very clearly written.
Yeah.
And it's a marvel.
Yeah.
And people put a lot of thought in it. The best example I can give, think about First Amendment, Second Amendment, Third Amendment. That means they weren't there originally. Yeah. They had to add them. Can you imagine those folks sitting around going, we forgot freedom of the press?
Yeah.
North Carolina, our rights are right up front in the Declaration of Rights where they belong. Yeah. No, our Constitution is great.
Yeah.
I've never had any problem figuring it out.
Okay.
Where else do we want to go? You know what? I'm going to take the break early, and thanks for staying with us. Again, this is a CCTA wake-up call. Again, thanks for staying with us.
What's the largest gun shop in Craven County? If you said East 70 Pond, you are correct. Since Drew got back from the most recent gun show, new guns have been pouring in faster than they can open the boxes. The large showroom at East 70 Pond, slam bam, full of firearms. New guns and used guns, long guns and handguns. You will find weapons for self-defense, hunting, target shooting, and collectibles. The team at East 70 Pond is friendly, courteous, and knowledgeable, especially in the area of guns. If East 70 Pond doesn't have the gun you are looking for, they'll try to find it. If you want to do a gun transfer, E70 Pond will help you do it right. If you are looking to buy, sell, or trade a gun, there's no better place to do it than E70 Pond. Of course, E70 has tools, electronics, trolling motors, and a great selection of jewelry. But their specialty is guns. And we're talking hundreds of guns. Come see for yourself. E70 Pond, across from Craven County Fairgrounds, New Bern.
Other restaurants claim their food is fresh and fast, but are they friendly? At Moore's, you're treated like family the minute you walk into their doors. With locations in Winterville, New Bern, Swansboro, Moorhead City, and Jacksonville, we've been practicing what we preach since 1945. At Moore's, our barbecue is slow-cooked and smoked over real wood daily until it's so tender it's falling off the bone. Combined with our fresh chicken, cooked-to-order seafood, and homemade fixins, we're sure you'll agree. If it's not Moore's, it's less.
At Professional Auto Service, keeping vehicles in top form and running well isn't just their business. It's the passion of folks who work there. If baling wire and duct tape is good enough, don't go near them. But if you take pride in your vehicle and reliability is important, go to 2215 Country Club Road in New Bern and let Professional Auto take care of your vehicle. You'll be pleased. That's Professional Auto Service, Country Club Road, New Bern.
Welcome back again. Thank you for listening to our sponsors and supporters. Justice, you have another story because we started talking about Shrimpgate.
So I do, and one of the restrictions on judicial candidates is we're not supposed to talk about current political things. I am aware, not having spent the last year in a hole, that the shrimping issue is significant in this area. I spent 11 summers at Camp Seagull further down the river and used to see the shrimp and menhaden boats going out and always thought that it was a lovely sight. I'm obviously a strong proponent of Article 1, Section 1 and the right to fruit your own labor, but I can't talk about a penny law. What I can do is talk about Mr. Oglesby. Well, who's he? Mr. Oglesby was a shellfish fisherman who in the 50s leased 20 acres of state land in the Newport River, just a few miles down the road from here. And the General Assembly gave him an 8-year lease at a very minimal term, you know, call it $10 a year. Well, halfway through that term, the General Assembly apparently decided that wasn't enough money. So they changed the law to say it now costs, it doesn't really matter, call it $50 a year. And they told Mr. Oglesby and people like him, if he was unhappy, he'd go to the Industrial Commission and get compensation. Well, you know what Mr. Oglesby did instead? He went to the Supreme Court. Now, it would have been really easy for the Supreme Court to side with the most powerful politicians in the state against an oyster fisherman from Carteret County. Well, you know what they did? They sided with Mr. Oglesby. They said that you can't pass a law that impairs the lawful obligation of contracts, and you particularly can't do that to get out of a contract that you yourselves entered into. So they ruled for Mr. Oglesby, and people asked me, like, what kind of judge are you and what kind of judge will you be? And it's the one who will protect people's constitutional rights no matter who's on what side. And because that is critical, that people's rights are protected. That is our primary job as judges, is to uphold the Constitution, to follow the Constitution, but to make sure the rights of U.S. citizens are fairly adjudicated and protected. So that is my shrimping story. I'm proud to stand with the Mr. Oglesbys of North Carolina when it comes to the law.
Excellent. You know,
bravo.
I look at that in relationship to, was it Keeley versus New London, Connecticut? On the
Kelso case.
And taking the land for
eminent
domain.
They took it for commercial purposes, not...
Yes, Fort Turnbull, I believe, was the location in Connecticut.
Right? Yeah.
And Trumbull, yeah.
Trumbull, yeah.
And it turned out that the company that went in there left in 2 years. So the tax revenue that they thought they were going to get by bringing in that business and taking that little old lady's shorefront cottage... never materialized.
That actually happened in North Carolina. We have a constitutional prohibition against spending public money for private purposes. And sometime, I don't remember exactly when it was, but I think it was Valdez, which is a town up in the mountains, did not have a hospital. And a gentleman wanted to build a hospital for Valdez, and there were some public funds that were being contributed to that. And somebody sued, and the Supreme Court said, you can't do that. Now, nobody thought that having a hospital was a bad thing. It was a good thing. But this was a privately owned entity, and we can't use public funds for that. So, yes, ma'am.
It was Kelo versus New London.
Yes, ma'am, okay. Kelo. So, fast forward, in the mid-1990s, North Carolina passed that Economic Development Act, and in a Supreme Court case called Moretti, the Supreme Court ruled that that could be used. And I obviously can't comment on the good or bad of decisions by our Supreme Court, but I can tell you that the law was pretty clear for 150-odd years that public money can't be used to fund private entities. That later led to, I believe, when they constructed a stadium for the Carolina Panthers. You know, they used a lot of public money for that, and somebody sued about it. And then citing Moretti, the Court of Appeals had to say that was okay. Because you know, as a Court of Appeals judge, the same way with me at my lower level, you have to follow precedent. That's another thing that you have to do. You can't just wake up one day and say, well, I don't agree with this. I have written analysis where I have disagreed with precedent at the same time followed it, but you know, following precedent is one of the hallmarks of our legal system. So,
is there no reversal on bad past precedent?
Well,
you can overturn it. Our Supreme Court does it.
Yeah, I mean, people...
Or you can go get the legislature to go and change the law.
Yeah, there's a number of ways, none of which are necessarily easy. Mm-hmm. You can, as you said, you can get the General Assembly. The Supreme Court obviously has authority to reverse a decision of the Court of Appeals. It has authority to reverse its own decision, as we've seen it do. There's a doctrine, I don't want to get too far into the weeds, called stare decisis, that essentially, and you know all about it, ma'am, but it's the idea that we don't want the courts flip-flopping a lot, but there's a beautiful Supreme Court case, I think it's called State v. Harris, but the title doesn't matter. But the Supreme Court of North Carolina said, yeah, I know we just talked about this before, but they said nothing is settled until it's settled right. So, which is some North Carolina wisdom, it's hard to argue with. But we get back to the issue of we want certain things to be consistent. You know, we certainly want things like land laws to be consistent because we don't want a different law when someone gets married in 1960 and a different land law in 2026. But, you know, my job is simply, as an ALJ, is to follow precedent. My job as a court of appeals judge, if I'm fortunate enough to be elected, would be to follow precedent. And I would defer, you know, to the Supreme Court, which is, you know, the way the government's set up, and mm-hmm. rightfully so. Mm-hmm.
And government changes should move very slowly.
That's right. I mean, people, I think, want their judges to do three things. They want us to be fair more than anything else. They want us to be consistent. And they want us to be legally competent. And if you can manage to do those three things, I think you're pretty well along the road toward doing the job right. And that's what I try to do. It's not, I tell people all the time, it sounds cocky, it's not meant to be. The law's really not hard. You read it.
No, but it is there.
Yeah, you read it, you apply it. And you don't do, I think it was what Hugo Black called it, what, a roving commission to do good. Mm. That's not what I'm about. You know, it's about doing justice. It's about following the General Assembly's direction and being consistent and fair.
Okay. We're going to drastically switch subjects.
Change hats.
Yes. Thank you, Judge Byrne.
Oh, thank you very
thank
much.
You. Thank Appreciate you. Appreciate it.
Thank much. You very much for having me. I'm really grateful.
Who wants to start off and say something about the State of the Union address last night?
Yes, Fetterman wore a suit.
That was amazing.
Wow.
That's your first comment.
That's the first comment, yes.
He not only wore a suit, he shook hands with the president.
Well,
this is probably the only sane Democrat in the bunch.
Well, I'll comment on it a little more serious than that, and that is, you know, it was the longest.
Yes.
State of the Union address.
2 hours
but
and change.
I watched the whole thing.
So did I.
But it kept my attention the whole time. And I think part of the reason was that President Trump not only emphasized the difference between what he's accomplished and what had he inherited, which was taking the country in absolutely the wrong direction. That was very well done. But he also showed the with his recognizing people who have been affected by some of these laws, mm-hmm. I think it was a very good example of what's impacting on the country. And he had the mother of the lady down in Charlotte that was killed, and he had those two military individuals, one from World War II and the other one that was just wounded in the Maduro raid, and awarded the latter the Congressional Medal of Honor, which was mm-hmm. really terrific. So he really recognized Americans for what they do to support the country, and I think that was great. And the other thing that I was impressed with, when he came out and he said, if you believe that the United States should stand up for its citizens and not illegal aliens, he asked the people to stand. All the Republicans stood supporting the fact that American citizens and their security and safety comes first, and the entire Democratic Party sat down and did not comply with what they actually swore or have to swear when they go into office. They have to swear to support the laws mm-hmm. and support the Constitution. And they refused to stand up. I think that was such a dramatic example of the contrast between what's happening now and what happened before. And I think any rational person looking at that overall address has got to recognize that going back to what the Democrat Party was doing during the Biden administration would destroy this country. And that was very dramatic.
I expect to see that clip on midterm campaign ads all over the place. But the interesting thing to me was Trump is always being called self-centered and narcissist and all this other stuff. At least 75% of that address was focused on other people. It wasn't focused on him. He talked about the accomplishments. Okay, that's fine.
He did say, we all voted, but my vote was more important.
He did say that.
Yes.
That was about the hockey team
yes.
medal. Yes. He didn't give it to the guy who lost his teeth. He gave it to the goalie. But it was, he really focused on, number one, people who had been impacted, but number two, just people who had accomplished really good things. And I thought that was what kept your attention for the whole speech.
The Democrats didn't even stand up in appreciation of Michael Dell when President recognized him for the $6.25 billion that he contributed to fund those Trump accounts.
And what that fund does, it gives every American a stake in the stock market, which is not a bad thing.
Every new youngster.
Yeah, yes. But the family is going to be watching that too.
Yes. Very good. Folks, we're going to take another quick break to hear from our sponsors and supporters. Again, this is CCTA Wake Up Call. Again, thank you for listening to our sponsors and go visit them.
Since 1952, the North Carolina Fisheries Association has been working to ensure access for fishermen and consumers to enjoy fresh local seafood. The North Carolina Fisheries Association is for fair, science-based fisheries management for commercial and recreational fishermen. If you agree with this philosophy, become a member. For more information, log on to ncfish.org. For fresh North Carolina seafood, there's no better place than B&J Seafood, Highway 70 East in New Bern.
Dr. Jay Singleton and his staff spend a lot of time removing cataracts, and they are good at it. Dr. Singleton has been doing a high volume of these procedures for 15 years, and the state-of-the-art Singleton Surgery Center is bringing costs down for patients and participating insurance companies. For dedication, experience, and convenience, you can trust the Singleton team. Dr. Jay Singleton and the Singleton Vision Center is conveniently located at 3515 Trent Road in New Bern.
Just who are these people doing this CCTA program? People in the community that love this country to protect individual liberty and to preserve the U.S. Constitution and free enterprise system. To learn more, go to cctaxpayers.com. That's cctaxpayers.com. Join Coastal Carolina Taxpayers Association and make your voice heard.
Welcome back again. Thank you for listening to our sponsors and supporters. Pat, you wanted to add something.
All right. My comment on the speech last night was that Hakeem Jeffries, Slobama, was asked by a news person what guidance he had given his constituents there to how they were to act during the State of the Union. And he said, I told them to sit there in silent defiance. Now, that is, our government can't work that way. If the Democrats are against everything the Republicans want, just because the Republicans want it, because Trump is in office, then, you know, we've reached deadlock.
When did we start, during the State of the Union speech, having the Republicans stand up when the Republicans said something?
That's,
or when there was a Democrat president, only the Democrats stood up? I don't remember that as forever.
Hmm.
And I would love to know when that began, because that in itself is divisive. When somebody says something that is good for the entire country, it seems like everybody ought to. For instance, when the hockey team came in. Now, I understand, living in New England, that we have kind of a different view on hockey than the rest of the country. But when the gold medal hockey team comes in, everybody ought to stand up.
Some of the Democrats stood up for the hockey team.
Some of.
Yeah. Not all of them, but some of them.
I was going to say, they didn't comply well with that silent defiance, because there were at least a half a dozen times, essentially, they all stood up.
Mm-hmm.
And they were clear, you know, it wasn't a gray area where the mainstream media could beat them up over, right? I mean, it was pretty solid position that everybody should stand for. But
the only thing, you know, that's fortunately, we didn't have Pelosi standing up, tearing up his address she did before.
Yeah, it's because she was sleeking down because of his shot about her trading.
Yeah,
trading. Yeah.
Well, yeah, that was very appropriate. I'm glad he did it. And the other thing is, I think this is the only time they've had 74 people refuse to go to the State of the Union address from the opposite party. 74 Democrats refused to show up.
Well, they
but
had
it
their show, own
it does
rally.
Show it does show the division that we're dealing with. And that gets back to some of the things Trump was talking about, like he wants the SAVE Act passed. And that is the act that would ensure that anybody who votes must show a photo ID and the citizenship. And then he pointed out that in New York City, you can't be hired to shovel snow if you don't show your
picture ID
card.
And your Social Security card.
And your Social Security card. So he pointed out the hypocrisy. But it gets back to the issue of, and the same thing with the tariffs. He pointed out that the Supreme Court negated some of the mechanisms by which he implemented tariffs. Now, he says, I have other ways of doing it. That's what I hope he does. But the point is, what's the chance of him getting something through the Senate that would give him the authority to use tariffs, because tariffs are a great mechanism for balancing the problems we're having globally. But the problem is with the filibuster, we get back to the filibuster, that is almost an impossible thing to reach when you need 60 votes and you only have 51 or 52 Republicans. You can't get anything through. So they're able to block it, which gets back to the idea this whole filibuster thing needs to be revised. Because I'll tell you one thing. If Trump and he does not get support in the House and the Senate, he will be impeached. They will impeach some of his secretaries. and they will tie up everything that he's done and try to reverse everything. So, you know, this filibuster thing needs to be dealt with by the Republicans. And unfortunately, with this Thune guy in the Senate, this Senator Thune, he's not willing to address it, and it's not going to be good.
Well, right now it's Mitch McConnell that's refusing to allow it to advance for a vote.
But he's not in charge of the
He won't let it out of committee.
Won't let it out of rules.
Now the other thing I want to mention, because the reason that Michael Burns is part of our panel today is because we're having a primary election. And I just want to point out that the primary election is where we choose our candidates. And if you don't show up to vote in the primary election, then don't complain about your candidate because you didn't vote. And so far, as of yesterday, only 5% of the voters in Craven County have voted in the primary election. We should be ashamed.
Well, I voted on day two.
I voted on day one.
Well, there you go.
I was 130. You were 131. I was 132.
Yeah.
And hopefully election day, which I'm always an advocate for going back to have elections on election day. All this two-week early voting, all that stuff should be eliminated, in my opinion. Hopefully that will strengthen those percentages. Because I know there's a lot of people that wait for election day, but
yes, so far 4,026 people have voted in Craven County. Yeah. That's it.
But we do encourage everybody get out and vote.
For me.
Dun, 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 dun.
And do your research. Find reliable information about the candidates.
That's easier said than done.
And the other thing.
Well, actually, cctaxpayers.com send out questionnaires to all the candidates in Craven County.
And Carteret County. Yeah, and also the state.
And the state. Candidates. And we posted them exactly as they came back. Language, punctuation, spelling. Nothing was touched. And they are up at cctaxpayers.com. So that is one place, if you want to get it straight from the horse's mouth, that is one place to go research the candidate.
And I think one thing, Mary, that impacts on the low turnout on primary elections is look at the congressional race for the first district. You have five candidates. Four of them, I think, have some chance of winning. But they're all good candidates.
Yes, they are.
Every one of them. It's not like if you go to a general election and you have a leftist person leaning on, from a Democrat side, and then you have the Republican that's clearly a constitutionalist and so on, it's easy to make that decision. And I think that's part of the dilemma, that we have some of these races. The present person accepted, of course. Some of these races, they're so hard to differentiate the candidates. And hopefully, to me, the critical thing is, I mean, the primaries are important. I'm not saying they're not. But the critical thing is what happens in November.
Well, we have, as far as I'm concerned, across the board, Republicans have some really good candidates running. Unfortunately, some of them are running against each other, which kind of complicates things. But we have good candidates. We need people to get out and support them.
I think part of the problem is voter education, because a lot of people, if you ask them what is a primary election, couldn't tell you if their life depended on it.
Well, we had that incident in Mecklenburg County a couple of weeks ago when there was a hearing with the sheriff, and it had to do with the death of the Ukrainian girl. And they asked the sheriff, what branch of government do you represent? He didn't understand the question. Then they asked him, how many branches of government are there, or what are the three branches of government? He didn't know that either. And then finally he said he was part of the judicial, and they said, no, you're part of the executive. And I mean, that's an elected sheriff, and he didn't know that. That tells me there's some room for improvement in our education system.
The thing that concerns me about the primary elections is that you don't have to, you as an unaffiliated voter, you can go in and ask for a ballot for the Democrat side or the Republican side. You can choose whichever you want, which puts the party in a position where you could have a group of non-Republicans who are selecting the Republican candidate. To me, that doesn't make sense. I've always been an advocate of the fact that Republicans should select their Republican candidate, Democrats should select their candidate.
But I believe,
and if you're unaffiliated, you should make a decision which side you're on, and otherwise you don't know what's influencing that election.
Yeah, I mean, it's been pushed through district events to try to get it to be a closed election, and I'm 100% in favor of that. I want to go back to something you said, Alan. They're the Republicans that are running, there are much less good. If we don't want to say any of them are bad, I'm okay with that. But there are some that are much less good with even great name recognition, in my opinion, without throwing out names. So I think the primaries, people need to do their homework and figure out the less good and the really good and go and vote.
Yes.
But you do have to do your homework. You have to do your homework. And you have to get out. And you have to help finance some of these folks.
Yep. You know, I was at a restaurant the other night, The Burn, to try the hamburger.
The best hamburger in New Bern.
Yes. And I was sharing a table with an older couple, and I don't know how this came up. I think I was telling them, make sure you vote. The primary's March 3rd, and we have early voting now. And I made a comment about, I don't like it that it takes days after Election Day to finish counting the votes. And she didn't seem to have a problem with that. That bothers me. We should be able to, we should know the results of the election on Election Day. What's so hard about that?
If we count by precincts, we could do that. Using paper ballots, we could even do that if we worked by precinct.
Well, the problem is you have these provisional ballots that people come in and they register the day they're voting, and then they have to verify who that person was. That delays it some. And then, of course, you have some of the mail-in ballots, but, you know.
Most of the elections, you know, I mean, they post, one of the things they have to do at the poll is post who got what number of votes. I mean, each precinct, they didn't have this until this election cycle now, although you were allowed to ask if you were a poll watcher and you could get that number and you could make them read it. But they are supposed to post it on the window at all the...
Are you telling me they're supposed to post on an ongoing basis?
No, on election day. On election day. Now, the early voting is a continuous voting cycle from first day to the end, and then that's kind of a day. And then, of course, that gets settled. Of course, you got a canvas, too, that takes a little longer. But those votes get settled before election day. So I think on the 3rd of March, we're going to know, but there are some provisions, provisional ballots and stuff that could change if it's a super tight race.
Yep. And understand that there have been races in North Carolina that have been decided by one vote.
That's true.
So get out and vote.
You know, the other thing, it's interesting that I know that we've had a couple of elections where we actually used photo ID and you scanned the back of the driver's license. In those elections, the turnout was better than normal.
What happens if we have a tie? How do they break a tie? Because I know when I lived in New Mexico, they would cut cards. Oh, dear.
You know what?
Works for me.
I'm going to leave that. Folks, we just ran out of time. I am happy to say this is the end of the CCTA Wake Up Call. Thanks for listening.